I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey.
My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet, as we've done for the last 36 and a half years on Sunday evenings. TechNet is a gathering of the clan of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, how it works, how to make it work better, and the individual components of antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and satellites and so on. The nice thing about the TechNet is it's not only a gathering of people who help each other, passing information back and forth about what they've learned over the years with their hobby, very educational hobby called ham radio, but the TechNet itself has got what some people think is a staff of experts. You've got a small WS2N who seems to spend a good section of his life studying everything that NASA and Japan, JAXA, J-A-X-A, and the other international space agencies, what they're doing, the names of the astronauts, and what they've discovered. So we're going to be hearing from Paul tonight with some information about the fact that the JAXA, J-A-X-A, the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, with their Hayabusa mission, are gathering a sample of a asteroid and going to bring it back home for a study. Another one of the experts we've got is Roy, AC2GS. Dr. Roy not only is a practicing physician, but he spends a good deal of his time studying the laws of physics. He's got some great puzzles that he's going to bring to your attention tonight on the subject of speed of light, neodymium magnets, and
repeater, timeout.
Things like the mass of asteroids in the asteroid belt, how many are there and how heavy are they? You're going to be hearing all kinds of things like that. A third quasi-expert is a guy who has studied antennas for a good section of his life, K2RIW. And maybe not everyone agrees, but his name's on a whole bunch of patents on the antennas that he has worked on. So it makes a good group. The TechNet is broken up into three sections by which you hear each one of those so-called experts. The first section where we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. And we get them in order. They give us their call letters and their name. That lasts for about an hour or so, depending on enthusiasm. There's no exact timing on all this. Let me drop. That's followed by Roy with his talk and some great puzzles he's got tonight. And then that's followed by Paul, WS2N, with the space report. I'm going to assume that we've already got Joe, W2RYY, signed in, because he signs in very frequently. He's a guy with a lot of questions. And we probably have Rich and EO is going to sign in tonight, too. Let's see if we have confirmation of those guys signing in, and anyone else who wants to check in. Oh, by the way, there was a beautiful ham meeting today at Levittown Hall, and you're going to be hearing about that. And Roy, by the way, was presenting some three-dimensional printing devices, a whole bunch of them that he displayed at Andy's table, the V2CVL, or at least in that vicinity. So people are also going to be telling us what great deals they got, or the ones that got away at the flea market, Hammer-rammer, I call it, but I guess it's a ham convention today that occurred in Levittown. So, if you've got a question or a comment, please give us your call letters and name right now after the beep. K2RIW listening.
I am here, Dick, with a comment and question. N2EO.
So, we've got Joe and Rich so far. Anyone else to check in with us? A question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. And comments about the ham convention that occurred today.
Dick, I have a question. This is King Bravo 2 off the Golf of Far by way of Echoing Southwest Florida. My question is about an 80-meter dipole direction facing to go back up to New York. Which direction should the dipole be set back in that control?
Very fine. 80-meter dipole. I think it says Kilo Bravo 2 Alpha Golf Papa. Papa, if I got it right. And what is your name, sir?
The handle is John Juliet Ocean Hotel November.
We got you, John. And 80 meter dipoles are something that we've discussed a couple of times before. Don't worry, it's not a duplicate, because there's always more to discuss about a simple 80 meter dipole. What is it really doing, and how does it do it? How do you best use it? So, anyone else to check in who's got a question or a comment for the tech net, please give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. Okay, maybe we'll have some people checking in late. And let's see if Joe is really there. I made a guess that he might be there. Joe, W-H-U-L-Y-Y, what beautiful question do you have for us tonight? W-H-U-L-Y-Y, K-H-U-L-I-W in the tech net.
W-H-U-L-Y-Y. I am listening. I didn't check in earlier, but if you want a complicated question, I can give you one. It's up to you.
Fire away with your question. And try not to bury us. That's a joke. This is called the technical net. So occasionally we discuss very simple things. Occasionally we discuss very complicated things. That's perfectly legal. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay. This is really not, probably not a complicated question. Freaking around the whole planet. Maybe a lot of people don't think about it, but how does lightning actually work? Besides the charged particles, because if you think about it, from what you said in the past, a lightning strike can be something like 100 million volts of potential with a current of at least 10,000 amps. And if you do the math backwards on that, that has to flow across a resistance of 10,000 ohms. Now, surely when the lightning starts from where it starts up in the atmosphere to ground, there's a lot more than 10,000 ohms of resistance, even with water, rain, and so forth. Unless I'm just simply missing something with the bigger picture here. So maybe you could delve a little further into this if you really think about it. K2RIW, W-H-Y-Y.
Interesting. Let's recognize that lightning is something that we amateurs care an awful lot about, because if it strikes our antennas and that lightning bolt that found our transmission line into the shack, the chance it's going to make you or your equipment unhappy. And where does all that charge come from? By some electrostatic process that's not clear, individual aerosols, small little blobs of water, being raised to a higher altitude because of a rising air current in a cloud, a thermal effect. And those aerosols rubbing against each other, by some means, transfer charge. Quite often a charge in a cloud builds up to many millions of volts. And those millions of volts, since air breaks down at around 30,000 volts per centimeter, in other words, if you've got two metal probes 1 centimeter apart, and you slowly raise the voltage across it, when you get to around 30,000 volts in normal air, you'll get a spark that jumps between the two. Well, you use that as an example, I think it's something like 3 million volts per meter, and you've only got a couple of million volts in the cloud, and the cloud itself might be a couple of thousand feet high. There's nowhere near enough voltage in that cloud to, by the usual air dielectric strength of 30,000 volts per centimeter, there's nowhere near enough voltage to bridge that gap between the cloud and ground, a couple thousand feet. Let me drop. So each individual lightning bolt, there's something more complicated going on there. The best explanation I've read, and not everyone agrees with it, is that a cosmic ray comes along, ionizes the path in the air, the charge in the cloud jumps onto that ionized path from the cosmic ray, and jumps the first 120 feet or so. There's enough voltage in the cloud to arc 120 feet, and it jumps that far in the path, the ionized path left by the cosmic ray. Then that charge sits there for the next fraction of a second, waiting for the next cosmic ray to come along. The next cosmic ray comes along in that vicinity, moving at some other angle, and so the spark jumps the next 120 feet. This is some of the explanation for why the lightning bolt is so zigzagged. It's zigzagged on average in 120-foot straight sections, because those series of cosmic rays allows that complete path to eventually reach the ground. And quite often you'll see a lightning bolt if you take a top photograph of it. Let me drop. You take a time-lapse photograph of it, and you'll see that occasionally there's a couple of parallel lightning bolts proceeding, and one of them might succeed in getting to the ground, and another one dies before it gets there. So when the path is completed between the cloud and ground, or cloud and cloud, lightning is a little bit more more popular than cloud to ground. An awful lot of that discharge doesn't take place in just one strike. Quite often there's a whole series of 5, 10, 15 individual strikes every 20 microseconds or so. So, cup
repeater, timeout.
As you can tell, it's a complicated process. But that strike, when it does happen, on average it's around 10,000 amperes. The 10,000 amperes is not because of voltage and resistance and Ohm's law. A ionized path, which is really a plasma, is a negative impedance device. Plasma, when you finally strike a plasma, acts opposite of common sense. Increase the current through a plasma, the resistance decreases, and the voltage drop across the plasma decreases. So, plasma, if you could strike a plasma in the laboratory and then measure the voltage drop across your two probes, you'll find that as you pour more current into the plasma, the voltage drop decreases, opposite of the way Ohm's law would behave. So this negative resistance characteristic of a plasma, more electrons get, more molecules get ionized when the current is larger, therefore the conductivity of that plasma increases. So voltage drop across the plasma is a very, very complicated process. I think Wes wants to give us a couple of words on this. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
Well, you already said it. So I have not much to say. The only question that my rights is, you're talking about the influence of cosmic rays on the lightning strikes, but you're not giving the information about the nature of interaction. That's what you're
saying. Almost all cosmic rays come from something in outer space. Maybe they originally came from a supernova or some other kind of major event a long distance away. So that cosmic ray, when it strikes our atmosphere, is moving at an extremely high velocity, faster than the speed of light in that atmosphere. Therefore, it creates sometimes a torrential radiation that sometimes it creates an ionized path. That cosmic ray, when it hits the atmosphere, creates a path that aids lightning. And so there is a coupling characteristic between lightning and cosmic rays, and that's one of the explanations that has been given as to why a sequence of cosmic rays, which are thousands of them occurring in one, you got a cubic mile of air you're studying, and there are thousands of cosmic rays striking that cubic mile every few seconds or so. There's really a whole lot of them that you don't see. But the lightning bolt does see them, so to speak. And the zigzagging of a lightning bolt probably is caused by a sequence of cosmic rays. The only thing I know of that's more prevalent than cosmic rays is neutrinos. There's something like 300 million neutrinos going through your thumb right now, every second. But they're so light and small, they don't do anything. You don't even detect them. Detecting neutrinos is very difficult. Neutrinos also seem to, the majority of them come from outer space events. So this is some of what I know. And you can hint, let me drop this. You can get the hint there, there's an awful lot that I don't know about lightning. I do know that I want to study the weather. Whenever I'm going to climb my 100-foot tower to do any work on my antennas, I want to study the weather to make sure that while I'm on the tower, a lightning storm is not coming along. I don't want to be on the tower when a lightning storm comes along. That's not the right place to be. My tower is a local lightning rod, and I don't want to be on the tower when 10,000 amperes is flowing through it. And there are times when a lightning bolt is much larger than that, particularly if it's one of those positively charged lightning bolts. Most lightning bolts, the cloud is negative compared to the Earth. Occasionally, the reverse polarity occurs, and those are the super loud ones that are very high in current. So, gotta be careful with lightning. Now, we amateurs all think because we put a chunk of metal in the air, our antenna, that it's going to be hit by lightning with high probability. You'd be amazed how few antenna structures are really struck by lightning. When if you were a lightning bolt and you're looking at the surface of the Earth, let me drop. What you see are thousands of trees with sap in them, which is conductive. You see thousands of trees, buildings, water towers, hills. You see all kinds of things. There's tremendous amounts of wiring. Every 150 feet down almost every street, we've got a utility pole with wires on it. And so the majority of lightning bolts strike those wires, strike those trees, strike all kinds of things. The fact that the lightning is going to see your shiny antenna and decide to select it is very rare. To be on the safe side, we put lightning arresters on our antennas. And we do various things to make sure that the lightning is somewhat handled. But the chances of your particular antenna being struck by lightning is a lot lower than you would think. This is some of what I know and a hell of a lot of what I don't know about lightning, Joe. We'll probably have some further questions on all of the above. So V2RYY, the guy who asked this fascinating question, T2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. You said something maybe 2 minutes ago, or 90 seconds ago, in your conversation, that the cosmic rays are traveling faster than the speed of light. Did I catch that right?
There's a partial yes to that, Joe. In free space, the speed of light is a great number. We call it E0. It's very close to 300 million meters per second. When you go out of free space, the atmosphere of the Earth, the coaxial cable or whatever, other mediums, almost every other medium, the speed of light is a lower number. Therefore, that cosmic ray coming from free space, striking the atmosphere, once it enters the atmosphere, it is now in a medium where in that medium it is traveling at the speed of light, above the speed of light. Therefore, it's going to give off this bluish flash called Cherenkov radiation, and it's cosmic ray. The speed of light is a lower number. Therefore, it's got to give up some of that speed, and it gives off Cherenkov radiation, creates ionization in the process. That's a little bit of what's happening here, Joe. To be 12YY, K2IW in the TechNet.
I thought initially that the speed of light was tested by some sort of complex machinery that was built a very, very long time ago, like about a mile apart, with a system of mirrors or something like that, and they measured against the timing between these two points, and it was tested in a vacuum. So you're telling me out and out in space, which is also a vacuum, it actually travels less than 300 million meters per second.
Turns out that the speed of light in vacuum and the speed of light in ordinary atmospheric air are fairly close to each other, a fraction of a percent different. So when Michelson and other guys, and you're going to be hearing about this from Roy, you'll be asking a question about speed of light measurements. The speed of light in air, when you measure it, is relatively close to what it would be in a vacuum. To make a mile of vacuum, other than what they did with the LIGO experiment, is very difficult. And most people who measured the speed of light didn't do it in a vacuum. Most of them did it in air. And then they can add a correction factor. The difference between the speed of light in air and the speed of light in a vacuum, there's ways you can anticipate that and adjust for it. So many of the speed of lights that were done with a tooth wheel and rotating mirrors and so on, where the two ends of the apparatus were either multiple meters or maybe a mile or a kilometer apart, most of those were done in air. Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2IW, the TechNet.
Okay, the last, I guess, sub-question within this is with part of your explanation. You said sometimes with, a super lightning bolt or whatever it's called, the cloud is positively charged instead of negatively charged. How does that how does that actually occur, getting a positive charge on the cloud? I thought it's kind of interesting to think about that.
The little bit of study that I know about that I've read about clouds, the way they get charged because of thermals and other effects at the beginning of a rainstorm, you'll notice that the lightning quite often occurs at the beginning of a rainstorm. So as that first thermal occurs and aerosols are being raised to a higher atmosphere, higher altitude, by some means they create and exchange charge between those individual blobs of water, so to speak, those aerosols. And usually the cloud is charged in such a way the bottom of the cloud is negative and the top of the cloud is positive. So there's a distribution of charge across the cloud, and the cloud itself is charged with reference to ground. Complicated process. Occasionally the way the rising aerosol takes place somehow does it backwards, and the bottom of the cloud, instead of being negative, is positive. When the portion of the cloud with the high charge that's closest to the Earth is positively charged, because positive ions are much more lazy. They don't jump the gap anywhere near as easily, but when they do, wow, it's a beauty. So it takes a higher voltage to break down a positively charged cloud, but when it does, you don't get 10,000 amperes, you get more like 100,000 amperes. You get some of these extremely loud lightning bolts that are much more destructive. So by some means that is not clear, the cloud can be upside down in its charge, or the bottom of the cloud is positive instead of negative. So maybe that's only 5 or 10% of the time during lightning storms it occurs that way. But when it does, look out. And I know of somebody who was once on a tower when lightning struck, and thank goodness he had a safety harness, because the current flowing through the tower made him let go. His arms flew out in the air.
Repeater, time out.
From the story I heard, his arms flew out in the air, and he was hanging from his harness. Thank goodness he had a harness on when the lightning struck the tower that he was on. So you don't want to be on a tower with these very strong electromagnetic pulses that occur when lightning hits that tower and you're on it. To B2RYY, T2RYW in the TechNet, wait for the beeps.
Wow, that sounds like a story you tell your grandchildren. I haven't heard that before. Okay, I guess the last part of this is with one other thing you said there. You said cosmic rays make the lightning strike travel about 100 to 120 feet. How do they actually figure that out? Was it done through photography or by some other means? Back to you.
Lots and lots of people have taken photographs of lightning. And by various means, you can figure out how far away was that lightning picture that you just took. And you look at all those zigzags. On average, the individual straight sections of the zigzags are in the vicinity of 120 feet long. And when you study the amount of charge that you know about in the cloud by flying a model airplane in the cloud and measuring the charge, is one of the ways it's been done. So you measure the charge in the cloud, the number of volts in the cloud, the number of megavolts, and the 120 feet, and you use the usual rule of thumb of 30,000 volts per centimeter, it comes out the right number. So in other words, the cloud has the right number of megavolts to arc 120 feet. Rough rule of thumb. And so the lightning bolt jumps that far, runs out of voltage, so to speak, sits there with that 120-foot chunk already charged up, waiting for the next cosmic ray to come along so it can continue the process. If one comes along at the right time, within a very short period of time, before that 120-foot section becomes deionized, it's only going to be ionized for probably 20 microseconds. So in the next 20 microseconds, you want another cosmic ray to come along in the vicinity so the lightning bolt can jump the next 120 feet. This is a very rough explanation that I've read a few times that might explain what's going on. But it's at least that complicated, if not more. The Polyphase Company has, they sell lightning arresters, and they've got a number of books on the subject of lightning. They give you a lot more protection procedures and a lot more
Good, very good. Thank you, Dick. Great answers and fascinating subject to talk about. On to the next guy, WHRY. Thanks.
Yeah, that story of the guy whose arms flew out in the air when he was on a tower and lightning struck the tower, I interviewed that person. Where he volunteered the story to me, if you know what I know. And we think that that kind of an event has occurred a number of times. Okay, the next person who signed in with a question or a comment was Rich, N2EO. N2EO, K2LIW, good, Rich.
N2EO,
Rich.
N2EO, good evening, Dick, and everybody else on the net. Dick, remember when we were talking about that, town, and it looked like the FWR was going up? I didn't believe what you said. Now I do believe, because I put my dummy nose watt meter in line today. I think you can be staying steady. Without the ballon, no problem. The ballon is obviously heating up. I call the size. He can make one up for me for $95. He said it goes for 3 kilowatts, and he said he's never had one come back yet. I asked him how he got into that business. He said he just made one for himself because he couldn't find anything on market previously that he liked. Then his friends wanted them. They started a little business. The guy's in Texas. So he makes them up special to order. So I'm going to order one at the end of the week.
Yeah, it sounds like you've gotten confirmation of what we've been suspecting up till now. Is that the previous ballon you were using, Palomar, Palstar, or something like that. Anyhow, it's the non-recommended ballon to be used with your compact antenna, your Cobra compact antenna. And the way you saw evidence of the standing wave ratio climbing as you increase the power strongly suggested that some non-linear process like heating of the ballon was taking place. And by way of Mr. Civic, I can't remember his call letters now. Mr. Civic is a ham radio operator who had an article 20 years ago, a series of articles in QST magazine about mechanically short ground plane antennas being fed with ballon. And he's one of the first guys that brought to our attention the fact that certain kinds of ferrite ballon, let me drop them, under certain conditions have saturation characteristics where there is either a temporary or a permanent change in the electrical performance of the ballon because of overvoltage, overheating, overmagnetization, whatever. So there's a whole art and science to building ballons with ferrites that do or don't saturate and give you some peculiar characteristics. So we have good reason to believe that with the current ballon you were using, your antenna could not tolerate high power. And by way of the new ballon you're about to get, it looks like you're about to see an improvement in that whole procedure. So, good luck with that, Rich. And it sounds like you called the right guy and you got the right confirmation of what we've been suspecting for some time. The next person who signed in was John, KB2, Alpha Golf Papa. I'm going to have you repeat your question a little bit to make sure that I'm on the right information that you're looking for, John, and on your 80-meter dipole. Kilo Bravo 2, Alpha Golf, Papa, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Okay, so I have a comment. If somebody can help me.
Okay, Dick. Okay, here's my situation down here. I strung up an 80-meter dipole on the back of the house. It's up about 20 feet. The legs go, I'm going to say, north to south. And the only thing is I have is a open power line. I think the voltage is 3,500 watt on the one leg, an open wire on the neutral. The noise level's not that bad. It's just that I'm not getting good reception on the dipole itself. I understand 80 meters has been terrible lately, so I'm attributing to that. There was a couple of good nights in there that I got that could get signals coming in. I could hear people, but I wasn't actually able to get back to the room. I'm only running 100 watts, so I'm not expecting miracles. So I'm just wondering, do I have the dipole set the right way to go back up to Jersey? There's a net on Jersey at 9 o'clock every night on 3982.50. So that's what I'm trying to make contact back up to the guys in Jersey. Over.
Dick, I did have a short question. If you would take it now or after the gentleman.
Yeah, hang in there, Rich. We're gonna go to the next. We're gonna finish John's question, and then after some time, we'll come back to you. John, the main thing you want to know is that almost every dipole fires broadside. In other words, if you're in Florida, when I think you're in Florida, and you want to transmit a signal almost dead north toward your friends in New Jersey and New York, you want the signal to go north, because the dipole gives you the strongest signal broadside, you'd like the wire of the dipole to be strong east-west, so that broadside is north and opposite, going to get the strongest signal to the north. So the wire should be east-west if you can arrange it that way. There's a slight exception to this rule, and that is the inverted V dipole. If you are able to make the center of the dipole much, much higher than the tips, then even though the wire in the that case goes north-south, let me drop. There is a vertically polarized component of the wire because of the heavy tilt to it, because of this inverted V. But that's not as strong an effect as you'd like it to be. The much stronger effect is broadside. So if you string the dipole east-west, you're going to get a much stronger signal north-south. As I said, they fire broadside. If you could see a diagram of a dipole antenna pattern as a diagram on a book, it looks like a, it looks like two circles that are touching each other. The antenna pattern, and where the circles are furthest away from the center point is where the signal is the strongest. And so the wire itself would be across those two circles, and I got it backwards. The wire would be right angled to the major axis of those two circles. So it's not easy to describe the diagram of an antenna pattern, but by way of the antenna book from ARRL, the antenna manual. So you could Google the word dipole antenna pattern, and you would see the pattern with the dipole superimposed on it. So broadside is the main thing you want to know about. I hope your property will allow you to put the dipole east-west so you get the strongest signal north-south. Let me drop. Even if you don't have enough property east-west to do this, if the majority of the center of the dipole is east-west, you will get the benefit of this pattern that I'm talking about. The ends of the dipole, if your property don't go far enough, can be zigzagged, made at a right angle, tilted up, tilted down, hat capacitors put on the ends of it. So you want the center of the dipole being east-west, and then use as much property as you've got to extend the ends of it as far as you can, east and west. Does that make some sense, John? KB2, Alpha Golf Papa. Papa, K2LAW.
K2YRW. Yeah, okay, no problem, Dick. I have plenty of room. I'm just going to move it. What I'll do is I'll move it, and I'll have the... I'll move it to the center of the house on the particular of the highest point, and then I'll have the each leg out of like a triangle coming down. I have enough room to do that. That's right. I'll just move the antenna on, and once I have that done, I'll maybe I'll say this week or maybe a few weeks from now, I might have everything up and going. But I got to get somebody to climb up there for me. I'm not going to climb up on the roof. I've got my neighbor who does roofing. I just got to catch him. So put a hook on there, and I'll string up the dipole, and I'll be that with a rope. So, okay, good. Thank you. I need to take that other station. I think that will solve my problem. K2IW, KB2AGP, down here, Cape Coral, Florida.
Cape Coral, Florida, I think it is. KB2AGP. K2RIW, Kilo 2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. This is my call, this is John. My name is Dick. And good luck with moving that dipole. Glad you got the property to do it. You will see a definite improvement of some signals to the north and to the south when your dipole is strung east and west. However, you know the way Murphy's Law works, John. The band will be closed the day that you change the dipole and you think you're not getting an improvement. Also, at high noon and daytime, you get a lot of D-layer absorption of signals on 80 meters. So 80 meters may open up very nice for you at nighttime, but during the daytime, 80 meters will seem like it's closed, particularly in Florida where you get a lot of sunlight. The sunlight creates a D-layer that creates a lot of absorption in the daytime on 80 meters. Make sure you wait a few days and a few different conditions of the ionosphere before you make a judgment as to how much better it is once you change it. On top of that, you might not want to throw away your current dipole. Let me drop it. Wire is not very expensive, John, and your neighbors do not see wire. We amateurs, we see wire. We go to a hand QTH, and we look up in the air, and we look at all the chunks of wire he's got. Neighbors do not see wire. Therefore, the fact that you've got a north-south wire dipole would be great for talking to people to the west of you, like Texas, for instance. So you could decide to leave that antenna there and simply string another dipole east-west with another transmission line. And then you can flip back and forth between those two transmission lines, depending on who you're talking to. And when you feed those transmission lines in combinations, you know, two of them in parallel, so to speak, with a D-connector, you might get some very, very interesting characteristics. So because a dipole is not very expensive, consider the possibility of simply adding another one and don't subtract the one that you've got there, because there are times the one you've got there is going to it's going to give you desirable things, if you know what I mean. Over to you for any comment on that one, John. KG2AGP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2IS, query.
Bill, we'll get to you in a second. Kilo Bravo 2, Alpha Golf Papa, K2IW. I wonder if some of that made some sense to you, John. Over to you, John.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I have all that. I have plenty of wire. I got a switch box. I'll just get it, order another dipole, through Amazon. And yeah, I'll keep the one I got there, and I'll do that. That will be, facing north and south the way it is now. And then I'll just string up the other one, up the east to west, and then I'll put a switch box on. Very good, Dick. I'll took too much of the next time. Thank you. King Bravo 2, I forgot, but I'll give it back to you, and you can cook up the query and the other fellow.
And those two dipoles at right angles to each other will be almost uncoupled. Not to the point where you can listen on one while transmitting on the other. They're not that decoupled, but still, they almost don't see each other because they're at right angles. Let's see what Bill's got to say about all of the above. AC2IS, K2IW, go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick. Sorry, I had an unrelated question about 5G. If you want to wait for that and continue with your dipole conversation, let me know. AC2IS.
Okay, Rich N2EO wanted to add another comment on what we were discussing. N2EO, K2IW. Go ahead, Rich. Maybe Rich got called away. Go ahead with your question on... stand by. It looks like Rich is back. N2EO, go ahead, Rich.
Oh, okay, Dick. Probably I didn't hit the button press. Thank you for picking me back up. I wanted to ask if you or anybody else knows of a good solid state 8210 meter amplifier. I'm not sure, I just came out with something called an ALS 600. I don't know how much power that is. Could someone look at it, please?
Okay, let's see if we've got anyone on frequency who knows of a high power 80 to 10 meter solid state amplifier that we can suggest to Rich. Although, I'm not sure you want to spend the kind of money that it's going to take to buy a high power solid state amplifier at this time, Rich. They're a little bit pricey, and you got to be awful careful with them. If you do something wrong with a solid state amplifier, you can wipe out an awful lot of transistors in a hurry. A tube type amplifier with a 572 or whatever type tubes, now they can take a lot of abuse before they go bad, whereas solid state, if it doesn't have a perfectly operating protection circuit built in, boy, you can wipe out an awful lot of transistors in a hurry. If you do something wrong, like transmitting into an open circuit with a solid state high power amplifier. But let's see if anyone wants to suggest a brand name and model number of a solid state high power 80 to 10 meter amplifier. Rich wants to know about. Give me a call, let us if you know of one right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I heard Rich say ALS 600. If that's true, you know, EAM has like literally 1,000 product reviews you can read. Looks like the average price looks like $1,300. But yeah, that's for that one if he's thinking about it. I thought I heard him say ALS 600. And the first guy who had it for 4 years and he's happy with it. Back to you, then.
So ALS 600, I think you said, is around $1,200. And with that model number, does that mean it's got a kilowatt of input and 600 watts of output? What do you believe is the power output of that one, Paul? Go ahead.
550, and then it says it will not run more than 600, but apparently this guy's running 550.
Okay, that's a possible candidate. So it's a 550 watt rated level, $1,200. And if you wanted higher powers than that, you could easily pay a lot more dollars. So they are kind of pricey. And I'm not sure that we amateurs like Rich are rolling in dough these days where they can go out and buy it in one of these solid states. So where you've already got a tube-type amplifier, you might want to stick with it because they're a little bit more forgiving, in my opinion. Now, Bill, I know you've got a question, so go ahead. AC2IS, K2IW, TechNet, you've got a Bill.
Hey, this is Bill, AC2IS. Recently I had heard somebody say that they were wondering when 5G was going to be deployed, I guess on the cell tower side. And also they seem to think that there was going to be more spectrum allocated for 5G, and it was going to be somewhere in the gigahertz range or multi-gigahertz range. So right off the bat I thought, well, if that is really going to be the case, that would bring up some problems with extra attenuation at those high frequencies, you know, sort of multipaths, reflections, and interference, and so forth. And then I started thinking that, you know, they might have to have a lot more of cell stations, cell towers, spaced a lot more closely if they were really going to do that. On second thought, I thought maybe they would only use these high frequencies for cell phones that happen to be very close to cell towers, and they would use sort of the original frequencies for things that were a bit further away, and maybe in that way they would sort of load balance between frequencies and support more devices that way. I was wondering what you thought about all that, if there's really going to be a gigahertz range frequency allocation, and also if the cell phone is transmitting in that range, are they going to be microwaving people's heads? So, and what kind of power level can they use for that? So what do you think of all of the above, AC2IS?
QGZ.
I was going to recommend that Bill QGZ, who works in that industry, who's going to give us a lot of words on the subject. Boy, am I glad you're there. Go right ahead, Bill. Wait for the beeps.
Yep, so very high-level W32QGZ overview. So, yeah, there's speculation that's already, a lot of people have, some people, I guess, will be trying to maybe buy. Don't know what the status of any of the auctions or anything are. So spectrum at, I want to say, 28 and 39 gigahertz, right? And that'll be used for, what's referred to as massive MIMO, so you have a big old panel antenna containing, you know, maybe 256 elements, and it is able to fabricate individual beams to serve individual people within line of sight. So that is primarily an urban line of sight, short range, hot spot of activity kind of thing in the short term. When you start looking at, you know, one of the configurations that folks want to talk about 5G for is autonomous vehicles. Well, you need to have ultra low latency, high speed, secure communications, you know, between all these vehicles, and some of that would be facilitated by the small cells, and then when out of range of the small cells, presumably you'd fall back to the conventional LTE network or 5G style modulation on conventional cellular frequencies below 3 gigahertz. Let me drop.
One of the things, when you come back, Bill, the main thrust of 5G is more bandwidth. I am guessing they're looking for numbers like 100 megabits per second of data rate to your cell phone-like device is part of why 5G is going to the frequency regions where there's more...
Repeater, timeout.
I think it's part of the reason they're going to the frequency regions where more bandwidth is available, like 28 and 39 gigahertz. So I think some of the motivation of 5G is greater data rates, like 100 megabits per second, I am guessing. Correct me on that one, Bill. Does the feature QGZ, A for the peeps, K2RIW?
Well, yeah, it does give you crazy throughput, but I can do 100 megabits today standing on my head. So if you're aggregating spectrum, for example, one of the places I'm familiar with has about 20 megahertz spectrum at 2.1 gigahertz, about 10 megahertz spectrum at 1900, and about 5 megahertz of spectrum at 700, and in some places 10 megahertz of additional spectrum at 600. And all of that can be aggregated, right? So you can do carrier aggregation, and you get the equivalent of that whole, all of those bandwidth added up together to stuff your data through. So you can, it's not uncommon to see a couple hundred megabits just sub a gig right now with conventional LTE properly handled. Yeah, so there's a couple aspects to 5G. So there's, you know, an ultra-secure communication, an ultra-low-latency communication, a low-power application for, like, you know, what they call Internet of Things, which is really like machine-to-machine communications, with a very, very low noise floor, very, very high sensitivity, ability to penetrate multiple floors of buildings, for sensors with long battery lives, things like that. So there's a whole lot they're trying to accomplish. And part of that whole 5G thing also incorporates some antenna steering. So at you know, the microwave bands, they have what's referred to as massive MIMO. So one antenna fabricates maybe 20 or 30 individual beams that find their way to individual handsets. And then there's some of it below 3 gigahertz as well, where you'll have antennas that can change their pattern from a 180 to a pair of 45s to a 45 to a 65, stuff like that. And that stuff's slowly kind of being...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, some of that did get timed out, Bill. Part of what's going on here is extra bandwidth. a need for going to higher frequencies where more bandwidth is available, because the aggregating process is not capable of being run in all locations, I'm guessing. 2839 gigs does have a propagation problem going through trees, therefore, except for the beam-forming networks and the phased array techniques at some of the more high-class cell sites that Bill was describing, except for those situations, I think there's a movement toward micro-cell sites on individual utility poles and on individual buildings to cover some of the shorter distances that are capable of 28 and 39 gigs. 28 and 39 gigs, in general, is not good for as much range, is my guess, Bill. So B2QGZ, worry about timing out. K2IW, yes, Bill.
Yep, so, yeah, again, the microwave massive MIMO solutions are primarily a line of sight right now, urban sort of fix. The stuff that's going up on telephone poles is either small cell or analog DAS technology, so that's just remotely located radios for conventional cellular for the most part out here. And one thing you can do, although I don't think anybody's doing this just yet, you can predict your propagation path, if you want to call it that, or your multipath solution, if you're using an LTE, so there's FDD, frequency duplex, and TDD, time duplex. So in time duplex, which is running here around, I guess, 2.6 gigahertz, you can start to use some of those massive MIMO techniques, or multi-beam techniques, multi-individual beam techniques, where you use transmit and receive on the same channel, which to me was kind of interesting. That doesn't work too well when your split is transmitting on 2100 and receiving on 1700. Back to net, WB2QGZ.
And I know that not everybody is going to understand all of what Bill has just told us. It's clear to say that the 4G and 5G are some of the expanding capability, greater technology that's being added by advanced analog, advanced digital techniques to our cellular telephone. The cellular telephone is getting more and more elaborate as time goes on. Understanding it all is not necessarily easy. But our customers are demanding higher voice clarity, less latency, in other words, less time delay between the transmitting and receiving. I mean, there are some circuits you can, on some brand names of cell phone these days, when you say hello to your friends and want them to say hello back to you, they say hello back to you 3 seconds later because of the latency of the way the signal is digitized in the individual radios and transmitted. That time delay is called latency, so sometimes that can get very annoying. Sometimes the voice itself acquires characteristics where you might not recognize your own mother's voice, if you know what I mean, on some of the not-so-nice working systems. Let me drop. So customers are demanding greater fidelity, less latency, more bandwidth. Who is it that just asked a question? Can you repeat that question, please? K2IW.
WA4YY with a direct question for Bill.
Go ahead, Joe.
How come some of the, I think they're called 2G cell sites at 1930 to 1950 megahertz being taken off the air and creating holes? What is the purpose of doing that?
WA2QGZ. Well, there's not a whole lot. So, you know, when carriers are looking at how they're going to distribute resources of frequency, and, you know, everybody's looking for throughput, you know, because, so the cell guy's thing is you want capacity and you want coverage, right? Coverage is good, but if you're choking on capacity, you need to come up with some additional bandwidth someplace. So some carriers have totally eliminated 2G GSM and have sunsetted that network. Other carriers have reduced the number of GSM carriers but still support it. And it's based on not being a lot of traffic there. So the elimination typically of a mode like GSM or UMTS or something is driven by handset availability, percentage of traffic there, and that's an individual carrier's calculation and decision. But if anything, the place that I'm familiar with has reduced the number of GSM carriers, but not the number of GSM sites.
The reason I ask, because there's a site on the east side of Sayville on a fairly tall tower that used to have 1950 megahertz servers off of it, not anymore, because I still have a test phone that tells me what cell IDs are coming out of a particular cell site, signal strength. The one I got to rely on is one about 3/4 mile away from me, which is about half the altitude of that one, and that one doesn't cover my house. I walk downstairs in my basement, the signal goes away. That's why I was kind of curious of it.
Okay, well, I suspect I know what carrier you're talking about, and I'm fairly confident nothing's been turned off over there. Something's definitely been moved around. There are some post-merge situations where a carrier has assumed the resources of another carrier in a merge and maybe put some technologies in the old carrier's lease space and not all of them. So there's some sites that might have been kept from another carrier that don't have GSM, but nothing's really been deactivated. It's just been moved around. In other words, so the short story is here, in 1900, UMTS is gone for the place that I'm familiar with. It's got 10 megahertz of LTE in it with two carriers of GSM in the upper and lower guard bands of LTE.
Yeah, I'm talking about the company you work for, the same place I used to work for about 15 years ago. So I know where some of the cell sites are. Some cell sites are still active, and others, some of the higher altitude sites, are they're using them for other frequencies because you can't get 1900 megahertz service off them anymore because I can drive around to the sites and the phone doesn't see it.
All right, we can do this offline if there's a specific question you have, but, you know, in general, none of that stuff has been deactivated. It's simply been the number of channels on each site have been reduced, but, more on the specifics later. Back to that.
Okay.
ACQIS for the follow-up question.
Control number one, ACQIS. Talking to cell number two, QGZ. As you can tell, a lot is changing on cell sites, 4G, 5G, microwave frequencies, modes of operation, allocation of resources, dollars, frequencies, bandwidth, latencies, fidelity, coverage, it goes on and on, and the whole system is under a tremendous amount of flux. From my point of view, it's hard to keep track of it all. A number of microwave journal and electronic design news and weather magazines nowadays have got lots and lots of articles that try to make it a little bit more clear to the engineering public what is happening with modern-day cell sites. AC2IS, with your additional question, go ahead, Bill, number one, K2IW.
Okay, this is Bill, AC2IS here, and I heard the other Bill say that typically, I guess, did split frequencies with the south side transmitting on one frequency and the phone transmitting on another. So I guess that means that the phones themselves will not be transmitting at these, whatever the frequencies were, 28 gig and 36 gig. I'm assuming that the phones themselves will not transmit in those bands. So please let me know if that's right or not. And the other thing is the only equipment manufacturer I've heard of so far as 5G goes, is Huawei. And in the U.S., and I don't know about other places, but there seems to be a lot of concern about sort of backdoors and surveillance capabilities that might be in that equipment without our knowledge. So I don't think there's any way to 100% guard against that. So, are there other manufacturers that we know of that might be an option for use in the United States? ACQIS.
Yeah, we're creating quite a bit of confusion here, Bill, in my opinion. In order for a cell phone to be full duplex, quite often the transmit frequency and the receive frequency are offset from each each other. And built into your cell phone is a duplexing filter that allows you to transmit on one and receive on the other without the transmitter jamming your own receiver. So quite often there is a frequency split. The time domain multiple access, where you can transmit and receive simultaneously on the exact same frequency, I think that technique is less used, and I think it has less range capability. Bill number two is going to correct us on all of the above.